Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Tony Wilson. Tony is Director of the Institute for Employment Studies, but he's worked around employment, skills and welfare for the best part of his career, including a time as a civil servant in DWP and HMT, which I'm sure we'll come back to through the conversation. Tony, welcome to City Talks.
Morning, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about the state of the labour market, the government's response to date, but also, in a sense, your thoughts and thinking, which I know you've done lots of work on and already published a lot on how we move to the next phase. But before we kind of dive into all of that, it's probably worth saying to our listeners that we're recording this on the 15th of May, Friday the 15th of May. It's a fast-changing environment, so some of the things that we say will be super relevant. Some of the things may preempt things that we may hear in the not-too-distant future. But 15th of May is when we're sharing our thoughts with each other. So with that in mind, Tony, just start from a... Give us a picture of the labour market as it currently is. In a sense, what's happened through the lockdown period?
Yeah, great. Well, I think the first thing to say is that right now, you know, unemployment is probably higher than it's been at any point in about 30 years. We think that there's probably now about 3 million people unemployed right now. We'll get new data out on Tuesday. This will be the first data that will really, the first official data that will cover the period since the lockdown. And the unemployment figures there might be a bit lower in the headline data because it uses a 3-month rolling average. But if you were taking a snapshot of where we are right now, unemployment's gone up from about 1.4 million to probably nudging 3 million. And that growth, you know, everything's unprecedented in this crisis, I think. But the speed of that and the depth of that, and the speed of that rise, I should say, and the depth of the fall in employment as well is you know, something we've not seen probably in our lifetimes. So that's a challenge, and that's even with the job retention scheme, which we'll come back to, which has saved millions of jobs. But of course, you know, the labour market wasn't in perfect shape before we went into the crisis. There'd been huge progress over the decades since the Great Recession, and the employment rate was about the highest. Well, it was the highest it had ever been. But even then, there were still 3 million people who were out of work who said they wanted to work. You know, the work you did looking at inactivity last year with the OECD sort of showed clearly that that we still have many millions of people, particularly with long-term health conditions, who were able to work but weren't working, weren't getting the support they needed to work. And if you look across the country, it's a pretty different picture. You know, we've had a lot of the jobs growth since 2010 has been in high-skilled, well-paid work, but that's not been shared. About 3/4 of the jobs growth has been in good work, but it's not been shared evenly. And some parts of the country... some regions in England, but also some of the nations, Wales and Northern Ireland, have fared far less well. So we were fairly well prepared for the crisis. The labour market was in good shape going into the crisis. It wasn't great, certainly wasn't great everywhere. But this has been a huge impact.
Have you seen, or can we imagine, sort of the, you know, that as if it is 3 million or it's something around that. Do we see certain cohorts that we are, you know, we're likely to be, you know, negatively affected, you know, beyond the average? You know, all of our data tells us that certainly when you look at geography, there are, you know, there is a geographical element to the strength of the labour market, both on supply and on the demand side. But is there anything more in that you would, you know, you would be guessing at even if we don't have the data?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a few aspects to this. One is who works in those sectors that have been most affected by the lockdown. But many of those people, bear in mind, their jobs have been saved through the job retention scheme. So there's really good analysis that's been done by Resolution Foundation, by Learning and Work Institute and others that's looked at shutdown sectors in particular and said, and it's found, you know, young people and women have lost out, have been most at risk, as well as some parts of the country. But the flip side of that is that the job retention scheme has shielded, you know, has shielded the impact or has lessened the blow for those groups right now. And then the big question, which we'll come on to, I think, is how does this unwind? Has there been a structural change in demand that would affect those people more? So there's that group. But in that unemployed group, because this is the one that isn't really getting any attention or not enough attention right now, you know, those rises in universal credit, those 2.3 million more claims for universal credit in the last 6 weeks, which is an incredible figure, seven times higher than usual. You know, that will almost certainly be being driven by young people in particular. And it will also be people who are, I think, who are more likely to be lower paid, lower qualified, more at risk of job loss. And there's two reasons why I say that. The first is, you know, through thick and thin, it's typically about 2/5 of new claimant unemployed are young people. So the flow into claimant unemployment, whether it's a recession or recovery, is always between about 35 and 45%. So if you think there's 2 million new claims for universal credit, that means we're talking about 700,000 more young people becoming claimant unemployed in the last 6 weeks. Now, I've got a slight caution about, you know, I haven't been sort of out saying youth unemployment's gone up by 700,000 because we do need, I want to see the data. There's quite a lot of speculation and we need to see the data. But youth unemployment was about 500,000 before the crisis. So we're saying it's, I think there's a decent chance that the unemployment rate for young people now is about 25 to 28%. This is, you know, this is an extraordinarily large and worryingly large figure. And it will mean, I think, the debate will shift on to unemployment and the labour market impacts of the crisis in the next few days, really. I mean, I think it's very likely we'll all be talking about will be youth unemployment in a few weeks' time. But they're not the only group. And I think this is just a really important point is that, you know, we're right to really be concerned about youth unemployment and young people because there's long-term impacts in terms of their health, their well-being, future incomes, their employment, their family relationships, and on communities where you have youth, you know, high levels of, well, for any individual who becomes like long-term unemployed when they're young, and that evidence is really well established. But in the last recession and in previous recessions, fewer older people became unemployed, but those that did were much more likely to end up long-term unemployed. And people with health conditions who are already out of work will be much more disadvantaged by this massive inflow of newly unemployed people and falls in demand than young people entering the labour market. So we can't just, you know, this problem is not just about how do we deal with, you know, current and immediate short-term unemployment. It has to be how do we help those who are now going to be much more disadvantaged. And that's going to look very different in different parts of the country, I think.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, the legacy or, you know, scarring effects that you've just talked about, our work looking at now the labour market in different places, you can see the sort of long run effects of, you know, the 1980s restructuring of heavy industry in, you know, in different parts of the country, and essentially the policy decision at the time to park typically middle-aged, you know, men onto incapacity benefit, where essentially they stayed for the rest of their, you know, their working lives, and then obviously into retirement as well. And, you know, that's a worry in a sense, again, that, you know, we don't want to be back in that position where, you know, this kind of long run effects just play out over generations in some respects.
No, we don't. And we definitely don't. And I think it's a really good parallel because, you know, the sort of the small steps that can lead us to these really disastrous long-term impacts, I think are happening now. I don't want to massively overplay it, but the first problem in the 1980s was that the employment services stopped talking to people who are unemployed, stopped doing the basic, that it'd be face-to-face. It can't be face-to-face now because we're all Zooming and Skyping and everything, but it was that initial face-to-face, you know, you're out of work, don't give up, we can help you find another job or a better job. And that stopped. It stopped between 1983 and 1986. And then alongside that, we then had, you know, relaxing of being able to get into incapacity benefits. We had massive deindustrialization, a lack of investment in the demand side and support for industries, new industries in those areas and everything else. But what's happening now, you fast forward to today, you know, the first thing we did with the crisis was to switch off all employment support for the unemployed. And it was understandable because we've never seen this volume of claims, and Job Centre Plus is a lot smaller now, fewer staff than it was than it was 10 years ago. But we have to, we must, like, and quickly and urgently be mobilising employment services, recruitment services, voluntary and community sector to, you know, to engage with and support the unemployed, to help to build their confidence back up, prepare for work, you know, think about, you know, get the right careers advice, the right access to training. And if we don't do that, we could absolutely find ourselves in, you know, this will get more and more difficult, and we can absolutely find ourselves in a couple of months with a much bigger crisis, and it being much, much harder to then actually, you know, help people prepare for and get back to work.
And we know, I mean, not least because of the work that you've done, but we know that sort of outreach, engagement, information, you know, matching process almost is really quite important and actually is impactful in terms of in maintaining connection in some shape or form to the labour market. It really does make a difference. It's not just this is a nice thing to do, you know, that's the way we should do it. Actually, the evidence is pretty strong in that area, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so we summarised this in the report last month. We published a report on, I think, the 8th of April called Getting Back to Work. And I got a bit of flack. It was well received, obviously, but I got a bit of flack for, you know, getting back to work. We've only just gone off work. But the point was really that you have to start. There's a Mark Twain quote, I think, about, you know, the secret to getting ahead is getting started. And you've got to break down your complex and impossible tasks into smaller, manageable ones, and then do the first one. And the point was, if we don't start soon and start quickly, then you know, this will get a lot harder. But the foundation, but in that report, we set out a lot of the evidence around that, you know, that point around how we support people to prepare for work and how we engage with people, and summarised it was work that was done by Professor Dan Finn at the University of Portsmouth, looking internationally at practice across public employment services. And this, you know, it pays for itself, actually. You know, good quality, cost-benefit analysis, the cost of delivering one-to-one, you know, high-quality work coach, personal advisor, career counsellor, whatever you want to call it, support, pays for itself. So I think it is always a good investment. And now, I think part of the challenge, though, here is that, you know, we have a very conditional benefit system, highly conditional benefit system, and it served, in broad terms, it served the labour market fairly well. I think there's a lot of issues with it. I mean, I really do. Don't get me wrong, but it served us fairly well. But the problem is now we shouldn't be and we can't deliver that conditionality piece. And I think public employment services will struggle with delivering the support without the requirement to attend. You know, of doing the carrot without the stick. And so I think that means we need to look at where this is being done well already. And a lot of countries do it in a far less conditional way, and there's good evidence of that. But so does local government. So do local employment services. So do European Social Fund projects. So does the Work and Health Programme, actually, which is not in all places, but in London is doesn't have requirements to attend. So a lot of this. So I think, you know, this is part of the point about government needing to be a bit more open to working with others as well, which we talked about in the report, is that, you know, we need to be talking. They need to be talking to combined authorities, to local authorities, and to the voluntary and community sector about how we get that outreach, that engagement into communities, how we best talk to different groups who may not come into contact with employment services or who may not want to, you know, because of some of the stigma with Job Centre Plus in the last few years, you know, who may feel less comfortable in engaging in a voluntary offer. So we've got to kind of, you know, it has to be about more than one thing, but the bedrock needs to be that one-to-one support, I think.
You called for or talked about introducing a sort of Cobra style government arrangement for jobs, which is, you know, high priority, cross-governmental. But you also have an element to that where you would want local participation by organisations on the ground, whether it's local authorities or whether it's LEPs or, you know, whether it's training bodies to be part and parcel of it. Just say a little bit more about your thinking behind, you know, the call for a Cobra for jobs, which I quite like, actually.
Well, no, indeed. And it's sort of, I think sometimes, I mean, you'll add this too, when you're writing a report and it's all a bit frantic and you're getting to the sort of last minute and you've got lots of ideas and you think, this is really hard to explain and nobody's going to get it. And that sort of light bulb moment, I will call it a Cobra for jobs. Cobra for jobs, sort of, you know, that will get a bit of traction. I mean, of course, I think it sounds great. It doesn't quite work in as far as like COBRA in government is about, you know, the ministers and officials talking to each other. The point in the report, the COBRA for Jobs idea, is really almost the opposite. It's that government can't do it alone. And if there's one lesson from every recession, certainly in my experience, my lifetime, it's that central government can't do this alone. So, you know, convening the right people at a national level in a small sort of COBRA for Jobs, to coordinate, to share expertise, to share ideas, to provide leadership, to line people up, I think, you know, is absolutely what we need. And that should be recruitment services, employers, trade unions, central government, local government, the voluntary and community sector, and so on. You know, you can end up with a cast list of hundreds, but I think getting those right people around the table would be really important. And it would also show that the government's prepared to be open to, you know, evidence and listening and ideas, which I think in this, you know, particularly in this crisis and the speed with which this crisis is happening is what we need.
And is it your sense, Tony, that the government, you know, where it currently is, and the departments that are, you know, front and centre of dealing with this situation, they're open to that kind of approach? You know, I mean, you know, there's always that sort of tendency, you know, we know different bits of government are more open to local initiatives, local engagement, local involvement in different things. You know, that's always been the case. But also, obviously, you know, in a crisis like this, the tendency towards centralization, you know, big government programs run from Whitehall, you know, pushed out across the country. You know, that's an inevitable temptation that we have to fight against in some respects, you know, to get that local initiative in. But, you know, where's the government currently in responding to or reacting to that need for more local engagement and more local variation?
I suppose I might have to be careful what I say here, but I think having in the last sort of week or so, you know, I've been lucky enough to sort of speak to a lot of people in different parts of government, and I certainly think, you know, there's huge appetite for evidence, for ideas, for insight, and so on, definitely. And I do think, you know, we're pretty close to decisions being made, potentially big decisions about our active labour market response to the downturn. But I do think there's an immediate point about what happens in crises, and that is that organisations retrench, and you know, you have to focus on delivering your core services, on making things work, and that ability to go out and talk to others is reduced. That bandwidth is reduced, and I think that's definitely happened. That's definitely happened in the last month, or the first 6 weeks of the crisis, I should say. So I do think, you know, government, it seems like government is opening up a lot more now. But we're starting now we're quite a long way into the crisis. But the second issue is that broader cultural one that you're talking about. And I do think some departments do take a dimmer view of this than others. And we do have an incredibly centralised political and administrative system in this country, and we still do. And one of my sort of bugbears about devolution, in as far as it's related to employment and skills within England, is that even when we've devolved, we've tended to devolve in silos in a very controlled way, where the scope to actually get the benefits locally are massively constrained, because local areas can't then achieve those economies across services, for example. They can't truly personalise it to the needs of their area or tailor it to the needs of their area, and they can't get that democratic accountability of being able to shape it for local priorities rather than national rules. Not always, anyway. I think it has got better in some respects, you know, in some places. I think the biggest risk in this crisis, when we think about the biggest delivery risk, if we do have a large labour market response, active labour market programme response, would be if government said, we can do it in Whitehall. We can commission a big programme. And of course, you in local government can input into some of our commissioning decisions, but we will choose the suppliers, we will specify the service, we will manage referrals, etc. You know, that will not work. It won't, for so many reasons, it won't work. And it didn't work in the last recession. And the things that did work last time out were where we genuinely and openly mobilised local government, voluntary and community sector, employers, recruiters and others, but within a national framework. You know, we are a very, clearly, like we're, as I say, we're a very centralized political system. There needs to be a clear national framework within which we do it. But we do need much better local involvement, decision making, and oversight, I think, of whatever we do coming out of this crisis.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that nicely kind of moves on. Next area I wanted to just explore a little bit more with you is for you just to say a little bit more about, you know, your thoughts and you at least initially laid us out with Jonathan Porter's around, you know, thinking about as we move to the next phase of the various government initiatives, job retention, furloughing, and the like, about how we need to both think about them, what the objective should be, but also then how we might need to vary them depending upon, you know, the nature of the sector that workers are in, the robustness of those industries, whether they're coming back or whether they're not. So can you just say a little bit more about, you know, your framing and thinking about that?
I think the best ideas in that essay, I suppose, by me and Jonathan were Jonathan's, I think. I mean, I managed to contribute an Alice in Wonderland quote at the start that, you know, we've sort of disappeared down the rabbit hole and Alice asks, what's where do I go? And it depends where you want to go, to which Alice says, you know, anywhere as long as it's not here. Well, if you just keep going, then you'll definitely get somewhere, which is, I feel like we've not had enough Alice in Wonderland or enough Lewis Carroll in this crisis. But yeah, on the future of the job retention scheme, I suppose, and what we do with it, you know, it's been a huge success, and the government deserves, you know, enormous credit for introducing it. It completely goes against the grain of our labour market policies for the last 50 years. Government stepping in to pay people's wages at a cost of getting on 80. I think it's going to be something like 80 billion by the time it's finished. But it was necessary because, you know, at the moment it was announced. I remember the day before it was announced, we had Butlins saying they were going to lay off. They'd served notice on 10,000 staff, I think it was, to make them redundant. That consultation process for large redundancies takes 45 days. So, you know, so that was happening as we were all watching it, even before the full lockdown. Government, I think, made the right call. They felt that, rightly, I think, they realised we were faced with literally millions of redundancies, and it'd be far better to be keeping people in work temporarily during a temporary crisis than putting people on unemployment benefits, which would lead to lower demands, would lead to, you know, detachment from work, long-term worklessness, everything else. So the scheme was a success, but partly the reason why it was a success was because we all anticipated it would be a temporary crisis and that we'd have a V-shaped recovery. And I think 6 weeks on, you know, in many cases, people will be able to get back to work in the next few months, but in others, they won't. And some of those jobs are going to disappear, and they'll disappear because of social distancing, because of people's behaviour. That, you know, people will be less, won't want to travel, eat out, shop, etc., until we've defeated the virus. And also, I think there's underlying things happening in the labour market that have been accelerated in the crisis. So we do need to, you know, we can't protect some of those jobs forever, and we shouldn't either, I don't think, because a lot of those jobs are also quite low paid and insecure work, you know, in the hospitality, retail, travel and tourism sectors. So what Jonathan and I were talking about was how do you kind of get off supporting jobs, particularly jobs that might not have prospects, and focus instead on supporting individuals and helping them to make the transition into better work. And what we proposed in the note was specifically about trying to create the right incentives to do that, potentially by rolling that subsidy into more like a credit that the individual can then take to help them retrain or help them look for work. But there's other things too that we didn't talk about in that note so much. I think we did actually. We mentioned about the rapid response services and redundancy response. But the one big thing we could certainly do is is ensure that we've got good quality, coordinated local support where people are at risk of redundancy or become redundant. And we actually do that fairly well in this country for large scale redundancies. So things like, you know, requiring job retention scheme firms to notify Job Centre Plus whenever there's a redundancy would be a great start. And then making sure we've got, you know, good quality careers and training support locally if people find themselves out of work or at risk of redundancy.
Do you have a sense, again, you know, looking at these kind of programs? Obviously, you're talking a little bit about looking at different sectors, you know, the strength of those sectors, whether they're crudely, you know, job growth or job decline industries. You know, one of the things we've been thinking about is whether even within industries or within sectors, you know, you will definitely see variation in performance, you know, from a geographical point of view. You know, the retail industry possibly is going to be stronger and bounce back quicker in somewhere like Brighton than it may possibly be in somewhere like Burnley. You know, I don't want to overcomplicate already complicated sort of policy decisions, but where do you think kind of geography fits into the next phase?
Oh, I think it's really important. And I think it's important for at least two reasons. Like, one is that the sort of the economic, you know, our labour markets are very different across the country, and we're going to need different responses, particularly if we're going to try and take a sort of a high road to recovery and try and do some of the things that we've not done so well in the past around trying to support more the creation of better jobs and better quality employment and better routeways from low paid work into better paid work in future. So that definitely points to the need for well integrated local responses, I think. And just on that point, I mean, the local industrial, I don't know what you think, Andrew, but the sort of local industrial strategies were touted under the last Prime Minister as the means by which some of that would be coordinated with skills analysis plans and better like alignment between skills supply and demands. That all seems to have gone really quiet now. But you know, clearly we do have we've got the emerging sort of infrastructure there, I think, to enable us to do that locally. But I don't know. I don't get a particularly strong sense about whether local areas are going to be able to sort of to use that as a means to think about how they can join up their supply side and demand side thinking.
Well, I think you're absolutely spot on. You know, in a classic, you know, we've local industrial strategies were then, and now we need something for now is a sort of, you know, would be my caricature of where we got to, which I think is not right. But you know, you can see that, well, they were of a different time. Now we need to go back to the bit. You know, there's always a grain of truth in those sort of perspectives. But actually, thinking about carefully, you know, what it was that we were looking at and why we were looking at them in through the industrial strategy process, I think we should, you know, we should hold on to the good things. But my other observation, which you've just alluded to, is I do worry in a sense that the connections between, you know, the supply side and the demand side are, you know, are often missing in many, particularly in localities where they're not really getting to grips with, you know, where bits of the economy are, you know, is actually growing and expanding, or indeed where bits of their economy are shrinking. And really, you want to be shifting people away from shrinking, you know, bits of the economy and trying to get them into growing. But it's all obvious things, but it's always amazing how often those two things are not always playing at the same way. I don't know what your thought is on that.
No, I think that's right. And I think, again, this plays out really differently in different places. So you have conversations with people in local government in London and the South East, I suppose, where we've got, you know, very strong private sector and a lot of job creation that's quite, you know, relatively well paid, quite low unemployment, but also really entrenched disadvantage in a lot of places, in coastal communities, in some market towns, in London boroughs, and so on. And the labour market response there is going to be very different to when I have had conversations in the last few weeks with people in local government in the North East, for example, where, you know, it is very much more about trying to stimulate demand through investment programmes. And I don't think we need more investment programmes. This isn't a controversial view. I don't think we need more investment programmes in London and the South East right now. But I think, how do we make sure that we can have good quality investment in more deprived and disadvantaged areas, but then critically link that up with our active labour market responses so that unemployed people are getting those routes in through apprenticeships, through training, and through just, you know, good quality job search and job matching support. I think it's going to be really important. And we didn't do that. We've just not done that after previous recessions. There's not an enormously positive evidence base around doing that internationally either, unfortunately. But there are good examples. I mean, there's good examples from the US about good quality sector-based, sector-based advancement programs. In fact, I think you guys have talked about this too, the work advance model in the US as an example. So I think there's things we can learn from, we can do better, but it needs to match, I think, infrastructure and public investment and trying to attract private investment with our supply side labor market response. And we can't do that. We just cannot do that from Whitehall.
No. And a previous guest on City Talks, Tim Bartik from the Upjohn Institute in the US, he's done some fascinating work looking at, the employment effects on local people for investment into disadvantaged areas. And what he finds is, he's saying with additional support to allow them to have a more than a good chance of getting those kind of jobs, the local take up of jobs by local people is actually higher than it is in non-disadvantaged areas because of the commuting effect is so much weaker in disadvantaged areas. So that, there are things to build on, I think, which is encouraging. But bringing those two things together seems to be a critical element of any program.
And I've seen that work. I will now listen to the podcast. It's going to be good to hear him talk about it. This is a good example too of when good intentions can go wrong, or when you can have or when things can have harmful effects. Because that work is a really good and helpful rejoinder to evidence to a fair bit of evidence that has shown that sometimes doing these things can actually be harmful because it shifts money around and affects people at the margins. But even in there has been research in the US about which has both talked about how commuter effects have led to actually increases in inequality within areas, but also that state subsidies, government subsidies that have subsequently been withdrawn can lead to greater levels of disadvantage when the money's taken away, because you then get de-investment and so on. So we need to learn from models that are working, I think, and we need to be careful. We need to be careful to try and do these things well. And I think that applies in our supply side labour market response too, because there's a lot of things, sometimes in the rush to do good works on active labour market policy, through job creation programmes and job guarantees and training offers and everything else, we need to, the first principle, I think, for all of us needs to be to do no harm. And we need to make sure that we're not inadvertently creating programmes that are going to be harmful or that are going to be impossible to deliver, or that are going to undermine people's confidence in the system.
No, so good intentions is no predictor for good outcomes of any particular policy. Even if we have the best intentions, doesn't guarantee that the policy we produce is will have the desired effects. But actually, that picks up on something else I wanted to get your thoughts on. You've been involved in, you were involved as a civil servant back in the day in actually designing some of the programs, the New Deal for the unemployed, the kind of Lord Freud and Labour government's kind of agenda, the Future Works, Future Jobs Fund, the employment zone. So, you've been in and what's the evidence that these kind of things are good things to be doing? And therefore, what's the appetite and likelihood for some variation of them coming back? So it's a big question, but just unpack that sort of, what do we know about policy that seems to have positive effects? What are the schemes that we should really be dusting down our understanding of?
So I joined DWP in 2001. So I left government in late 2011, I think, left the Treasury in late 2011. So the New Deal started a bit before my time, to be fair.
I didn't mean to add more years to you.
Well, also, I wouldn't want to try to claim credit for things that happened when I was still at school. Not quite. Certainly wasn't in the department, but during the recession in particular. So I worked, I should say for my sins, I worked on the Freud review in 2005 with Lord Freud as part of his team, and then then during the recession, led on the Future Jobs Fund specifically, and did various jobs in between. But I think in terms of what works, I think the key point is it's different strokes for different folks. There's no one size fits all. That's a really easy thing to say. It's harder to kind of to make sense of that and make that real. I personally think it's really hard to know what the labour market is going to look like in a year's time, 6 months' time. But when we're thinking about our our sort of program response, we do need to be thinking ahead to what we're going to face in 2021, because that's realistically when we will have provision in place and motoring, you know, going at full speed. And personally, I think there's a decent chance that 2021 will look quite a lot like 2001, that there'll be very high long-term unemployment. That's guaranteed. We are going to have exceptionally high long-term unemployment. But also, we could have an economy that is producing a shed load of jobs. I mean, we may not, but you know, the fundamentals in the economy were pretty strong going into the recession. We don't have, this wasn't a banking crisis. You know, this demand will recover when we beat the virus. And hopefully, with the right macroeconomic, a lot of this is about the macro response, with the right macroeconomic policies, employers with the confidence to invest again. And as long as we don't have massive austerity, then public sector investment and hopefully a, you know, relatively and a manageable tax burden will mean that we'll hopefully be, you know, be stimulating demand and supply. So in those circumstances, if we've got very high long-term unemployment and high job creation, you know, our job in public policy needs to be to make sure that the long-term unemployed are at the front of the queue and are getting those jobs, because otherwise they'll, you know, with a massive labour supply, they'll become more and more detached. And the lessons, you know, the New Deal programmes were the best evaluated programmes we've had in this country, and also the most successful as a package of measures. And pretty much, you know, most of the European Union, most countries in Europe ended up following them one way or another over the following decade. Germany in particular, you know, the labour market miracle in Germany, which again, not perfect. There's lots of problems in the German labour market. But it was based on largely reforming their public employment services to look a lot like Job Centre Plus and to have programmes a lot like the New Deal. So the key lesson there, I think, is it's about that high quality, small caseload, one-to-one professional advisory support, absolutely. But it's also then about them having the right options to refer people into that meet people's needs. And that's going to be, some of that will be short pre-employment training. Some of that might be longer term training. Some of it will be short pre-employment training in a workplace leading to a work experience and a job interview and a job. And the sector-based work academies that the coalition government introduced are one of the unsung successes, actually, of labour market policy in the last 5 years. A really successful model, really successful, quite small scale, but based on like 6 weeks of pre-employment training, up to 8 weeks of a work placement and a guaranteed job interview, and really impressive results. So it's things like that, but then it's also about the kind of the wraparound support that people might need if they just need a bit of money to get suited and booted for work, if they need help with their childcare, if they've got a manageable health condition but need access to specialist support, if they need adjustments in the workplace, you know, all these things. And you can build that in when you design your programs. And so we can learn from that. You know, we can learn from what we did then, but also things like employment zones where private sector providers mostly were given a lot more freedom to experiment and do things differently with often really good results. And even the work programme. The work programme's had a terrible rap over the years, but there was some really good innovative practice in there, and a lot of it was voluntary and community sector led. And it was all about that kind of personalised, work-focused but supportive approach. So we can learn from all that. There's then a question, do you have a jobs guarantee, for example, jobs and training guarantee for young people, which I personally would advocate. I believe that's the right thing to do for long-term unemployed people.
And would that be an actual jobs guarantee, Tony? I mean, a guarantee of a job or guarantee of a positive outcome?
So my thinking, and this is kind of, I suppose, our thinking at this point, because there's quite an active youth employment group that brings together, the Centre for Cities has been involved in as well, actually, that Elena's been involved in. But it's about 70 organisations altogether, and it's been led by Prince's Trust, Impetus, Youth Futures, Youth Employment UK, and ourselves. And I think, the evidence, you know, the evidence is compelling enough about the impacts, the really significant harm that long-term unemployment causes for young people, and the significant fiscal cost of long-term youth unemployment, that we need to sort of avoid it at all costs. What might that look like? I think right now, this summer, for any young person, so we do a lot of work looking at vacancy data, online vacancy data, and vacancies have fallen in the last year faster than at any point since records began in 1948. You know, the labour market right now is not a labour market that anyone wants to be looking for work in. It will get better, but right now it is not good. And we, as I say, we've probably got more than 1 million young unemployed people, and we've got 500,000 leaving education in the summer. So if you're thinking about a hierarchy, I'd say right now the priority for young people should be, I think, to try and find, you know, really good quality education, training, learning opportunities that will enhance their human capital, that has maintenance support built in, and that means they can enter the labour market a bit later when it's better. Resolution Foundation have done really good work showing how people who enter the labour market in the depths of a recession, and IFS as well have done the same, in the depths of a recession, face long-term scarring effects as well, particularly lower qualified young people. So I'd say first priority is, you know, the September promise and education opportunity, good education opportunities for all. The second should be a good job in the open market, ideally a permanent job with training and prospects. If you can't do that, then I think you're into then, how can we ensure that people do not become long-term unemployed and are able to do stuff that in the long run will prepare them better for work, for good quality permanent work? And I think that does mean looking at job creation, temporary job creation programs, transitional job models like the Future Jobs Fund. The problem is, two problems. One is it takes a long time to get that sort of stuff running at scale. I think, you know, we wouldn't have that in place before next year. And the second is, you know, these are by definition temporary jobs. And, you know, they're not going to be right for everybody. So we need to make sure that they're really good quality jobs, that they look like and feel like real jobs, but they've got the right support to move into a permanent and a better job at the end of it. And that means, I think, as well, we need to target that support at people who are reaching or are already long-term unemployed. Because if you start diverting, this is a do no harm point. If we start diverting people towards job creation programs when they're a month or 2 months unemployed, we could end up doing more harm than good if we're not careful. So this will not be easy for government. It really won't. And we need, at all costs, we need to avoid another sort of 100,000 tests, you know, target chasing fiasco where it's all about the numbers. This has to be about quality.
And what's your sense? I mean, I've heard this a lot. I'm sure you do as well. You know, and this is not a political point. It's just an observation, which is, you know, 10 years of public sector austerity, you know, lots of services, lots of localities are, you know, struggling to balance the books in terms of beyond the very statutory core responsibilities that they've got. You know, if you go back 10 years or, you know, even slightly more into the mid 2000s, you know, there was more money in the system for the kind of things that you've just talked about. And so your thoughts on just the monetary point, but also, you know, the robustness, the capability of the system to, you know, to step up to doing what seems to me to be quite a big requirement. And then it says, what would be needed to get us to that point?
Yeah. Well, what's the answer? I mean, I think it would be really hard. I think this is, you know, this is a bigger crisis than we've ever faced before, although the recovery should be quicker. I don't think it'll be quick. I think we're in this for the long haul. I think this is a 5 or 7 year job to get the labour market back to where it was. But we're doing this, you know, we're in this crisis. We're probably starting from a more challenging position, a worse position, frankly, in terms of our, you know, the public sector's ability to do this because there's fewer people in it, and it has suffered from those reductions in spending. And that, and like, you know, like you, I'm not making that as a political point. That's just where we are. That's just the position we're in. I suppose an observation, a reflection on 2008, 2009, like when I was doing the Future Jobs Fund, it started off with two of us basically, and with support, you know, with support from others, but two of us trying to write. It actually came out of do you remember the Houghton Review, Steve Houghton's review in 2008?
Yes.
Yeah. So I remember talking to Dave Simmons, who was helping Steve on that review in autumn 2008, and him saying, what would be helpful in terms of trying to convince officials about doing a jobs fund type program? The Housing Review came out with some stuff on creating a challenge fund. And then Richard Layard and Paul Gregg were then in the early part of 2009 writing papers about this. James Purnell himself and his advisors were really keen on it. But it's got this momentum over a few months. And then, of course, officials often don't come up with these ideas themselves, and then dispatched to go and work out how to do it. So it's off I went to kind of figure out how are we going to deliver an intermediate labour. I sort of knew the evidence around ILMs pretty well anyway, because they'd been trialled a few years previously. So it started off with a few people, but we were able over 4 or 5 months to scale up to a team of probably less actually, 3 or 4 months to scale up to a team of 25 who were doing, you know, who were out and about drumming up bids. We had every single government office region had a team of 3 or 4 three or four people, as did the nations, who were out working in those areas, drumming up bids, making sure every part of the region was covered. We had the trade unions and the employer bodies around the table in every region, assessing bids, but also supporting the bid generation point. Like, we did a roadshow around every part of the country to, you know, talking to hundreds of people, to both in the design and then in encouraging bidding. We assessed like 600 bids in 6 months, I think, had a team of 8 people managing the grants themselves. It was a massive operation. Now, and so I think doing something on that sort of scale, I think, you know, could be, you know, might not be possible with the time and the capacity that we've got in government. They've definitely got the capability to do it. I mean, I think DWP, I think Job Centre Plus has got the best employment advisors in the country. It's certainly got the most. And I think the department has got, you know, some of the best people who, you know, working on labour market programmes and labour market policy. But, yeah, you know, I think it would be a massive job. I think it would be a huge job and probably beyond the capacity we've got in government to do something on that scale again over the next few months. Again, though, you know, what does that mean? I think that probably means a much more partnership-based approach and working with and through local government and local partners a lot more than we did in the last recession. So, yeah, not impossible, but I think it'd be really challenging.
Well, and that touches on the last area I wanted just to get your reflections on as we come to a close, as to whether you think, you know, the political economy of the labour market and the public sector engaging in the labour market is likely, could be changed, will be changed, won't be changed because of the you know, the crisis that we're going through. We've typically, you know, had a do the bare minimum type, you know, approach to the labour market over the last, you know, X years. I wonder whether you think that, you know, we might end up being much more interventionist and the political economy of that might change because of the virus. I don't know. That's going to be a big question for final thoughts on.
No, but I think it's, so to be honest, I was thinking a bit earlier, like the one thing we haven't really talked about is the state of low paid work in this country. And I think people listening to this now, listening to this when it goes out, we'll probably think that's all very well, but, you know, I've got a slightly utopian view about how these things work, and the reality is that's not people's experience of low paid work, and it really is, you know, it really isn't. You know, a lot of it is insecure. You know, pay's not great. There's a real imbalance in power between employers and workers. A lot of low paid work has got really poor prospects. You know, and in particular in sectors like retail, hospitality and social care, and you've done work on this as well about what's explaining that long tail, as it were, of low paid and often insecure work. So yeah, and I think those three sectors, hospitality, retail and social care, are all under the spotlight at the moment for different reasons. But particularly when you're looking at the situation in social care, I mean, I do hope that coming out of the crisis, you know, it's an opportunity for us to have a proper look and a frank look at how we've got here and how we fund and how we support and value care workers. But the bigger point here, I think, is we need to do much more and do much better to make the labour market, and particularly the low-paid labour market, more rewarding, more secure, and have better prospects for people to progress, but also to be able to have fulfilling work. And this matters in particular, I think, because if we can't do that, then it's really hard to maintain public confidence in our wider employment system and in how we're going to respond to the crisis. What does that mean for the future? I think it means fundamentally we've got a problem right now. We've got an immediate crisis, and we need to respond and we need to intervene to maintain support for unemployed people, to increase support and begin to prepare for the rise in long-term unemployment that we'll face next year. But at the same time, like, you know, we need to look again at our labour market approach and at our labour market model. And I don't think that's going to be straightforward. But, you know, we've got to do more to make work better, make it more secure and more rewarding. And in particular, you know, that we're making sure that for lower paid workers and people in more disadvantaged areas, that we're able to sort of to make work better and do the right thing.
An excellent and challenging point to finish on. My guest today has been Tony Wilson. Tony, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter, at Centre4Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.